It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As moviegoers celebrate the release of two very different movies, Barbie and Oppenheimer, we check in with Miss America Grace Stanky, who has ways to identify with both film subject matters. News outlets call Grace Barbenheimer personified, and you can join the conversation along the way. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Grace Stanky is a nuclear engineering student at UW-Madison and the crowned Miss America 2023. Grace, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's such a joy. I always love it when it's specifically Wisconsin media. It makes me so happy.
Excellent. What do you make of Barbenheimer and memes and being called Barbenheimer personified?
Yeah, you know, it's a really crazy thing because it was just like yesterday or last Friday morning, I woke up and then all of a sudden I was in memes and everything, which is a really wild experience if you've never had that happen. But it's really an incredible opportunity, I think, to highlight both what women can achieve and then also this incredible industry that I work in, working on nuclear energy specifically. You know, Oppenheimer is about the weaponry side, but the nuclear industry has so much more to offer, whether it's on power production or agriculture or medicine uses. It's so incredible.
On the Barbie side of things, why do you think people relate pageantry to Barbie dolls?
Well, Miss America does have a deep-rooted history in terms of being more of a beauty contest. However, we have evolved past that. And I haven't seen the new Barbie movie yet. I'm working on it if I can find the time. but I think one thing that is common between this new sort of era of Barbie and what Miss America stands for now is it stands for who you are, right? And I think that Miss America is what type of leader are you in your community? What change do you want to bring to the people around you? And that's creating strong, powerful women leaders for the future.
Going back to what you said about waking up and just being in the middle of these memes, and you know, social media, it can be a toxic space. There was a survey by Pew Research that found 41% of Americans have experienced online harassment. 75% of them say their harassment occurred on social media. And I'm wondering, how do you navigate moments like these when more people are talking about you?
Yeah, you know, I'm a person that doesn't really get bothered by hateful comments, I guess. It usually fuels me a little bit, which is probably not great, but it's something that I am very comfortable with. At the end of the day, I think a lot of what my confidence comes from is knowing how I feel about myself and not really caring what other people think of me. It's, am I happy? Am I enjoying what I'm doing? Do I care about what I'm doing? If the answer to all those is yes, then I usually don't let other people bother me too much.
Where did you learn that self-esteem?
Honestly, Miss America itself did teach me a lot from participating in this organization. But otherwise, just my upbringing. You know, my parents were always very certain to promote a very confident and challenge accepting, I guess, personality in me. And I'm very thankful for that.
We're talking about the Barbenheimer phenomenon with Grace Stanky, Miss America 2023 and a nuclear engineering student at UW-Madison. You can join the conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Both movies address the concept of responsibility, and I think we can unpack this. In Barbie, there's questions about Mattel's influence on girls who play with the dolls. And then in Oppenheimer, there's the question of how much responsibility that scientists have and what comes out of their work. What came up for you when you saw Oppenheimer?
Yeah, the biggest thing is it really does ensure and validate, you know, how immense of a responsibility that is, where what is the moral dilemma in a sense. As somebody who enjoys the scientific side of things, you know, I think sometimes the philosophical and the political side of things are forgotten when you get so excited about a scientific discovery, right? Or something tremendous in that sense. And Oppenheimer really does highlight that, where honestly, I think most of that movie is talking about the political and the moral struggle of what do you do once you've created this new type of technology, that what is the world going to do with it? And that's something that I think truly is good for people to see and good for people to learn, because that not only applies to nuclear weaponry, that applies to things like ChatGPT, that applies to things like artificial intelligence and all of these new types of technologies that we're seeing. There is immense good that comes out of them, but there is also the potential of not so good things.
Do nuclear engineering students have these conversations, whether it's in their classrooms or whether it's in their learning circles? Do they have these conversations about the moral struggle and the history of nuclear weapons?
We do have to take ethics courses. Honestly, we don't talk a ton about weaponry, though, because it is such a small portion of our industry. And I do believe that there's a lot of non-proliferation work going on around the world. Within the nuclear world, I guess, I would say weaponry really only makes up about 5% of what we do. Most of us are going on to cure cancer or create clean, zero carbon energy. Right now, America's powered 20% of its power comes from nuclear energy. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't know. That's a very large amount of energy to be using. And it's a good thing. And that's where, like I had said, there's good uses and bad uses. And we're learning how to use nuclear technology for good, because if it can create what Oppenheimer talks about and what Oppenheimer created, then we can use it for good too.
As you get deeper into your nuclear engineering program, what area attracts you most and why?
I'll be primarily working in the power sector, is what I see happening. I enjoy the energy production, the medicine side of things. It's a side story here, but my dad's a two-time cancer survivor. He's alive today because of nuclear medicine, and it helped save his life, and I couldn't be more thankful. But because of that, I think if I went into medicine, it would hit just a little bit too close to home. I'm not very good at separating the emotions in that scenario, but so I'm planning on working in the energy industry and creating clean electricity for people to use for decades to come.
When you watched Oppenheimer, was there a particular character that you could relate to most?
Not particularly, in all honesty. It was a very fascinating movie, primarily because I had a lot of background knowledge about the Manhattan Project going into it. So it's comparing, okay, what I know actually happened to how the movie portrayed it, which they did an excellent job. There was only a few small things that I would say I would want to see different. But ultimately, I think that they portrayed each of the characters in a very real way, which is an important aspect.
I know, sometimes scientists, they watch movies and they just shake their head because like a scientist in the real world of science, it couldn't happen. Did you see any of those types of oops?
The thing is the movie didn't focus necessarily on the how of the technology. I think if they had focused on the how of the technology, then there would be some
Some
scientists out there that are
scrutiny.
shaking their head, that are a little, yeah, that are a little bit upset, But this was a movie that focused on the culture and the moral implications and the political scene at the time. Which it was funny, because walking out of the movie, I watched it with my parents, and my dad is like, "Wow, politics really hasn't changed, huh?" And I'm like, "Ooh, that's rough." But it's something that I think that they did a good job with describing the political and the moral scenario that everybody was in at that time.
Miss America 2023, Grace Stanky, UW-Madison nuclear engineering student with real-world insights on the Barbenheimer effect, Hollywood's dual release of Barbie and Oppenheimer. Be part of this conversation. Have you seen these movies? Call in with a question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As Barbie and Oppenheimer become summer blockbusters, the reigning Miss America, Grace Stanky, reflects on how she views these films as a nuclear engineering student at UW-Madison. You can join the conversation with your perspective as well. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Grace, part of the movie Oppenheimer takes place at UC Berkeley. Robert Oppenheimer taught physics there. How does your experience as a nuclear engineering student relate to the portrayal of nuclear academics in the movie?
Yeah, it's a very small class setting, and I think that that relates back into the movie where you've got a couple of students and you get to know each other really, really well. And that's something that is pretty accurate there.
How can we make nuclear engineering and other areas of engineering more diverse, more inclusive in academia and in the professional world?
One of the things that I believe can be done to help increase this is honestly just letting more people know about what the nuclear industry does. This is what I do a lot as Miss America, is talk about where is nuclear all around us, right? We use nuclear science in our smoke detectors and exit signs. You know, bananas are a little bit extra radioactive. Nuclear science is really all around us. We just need more people that are curious about it, that are wanting to learn about it. And I think that it's partially the nuclear industry's fault for not communicating how our industry truly is everywhere to most people. And we're trying to make up for that right now. That's what I'm working on. That's what I hope that people listening who are curious about this, wherever you come from, all walks of life, you know, that's something that this is worth pursuing.
You talked about nuclear medicine and the impact it had on your dad. Can you explain what nuclear medicine is and its impact?
Yeah, you know, nuclear medicine is a very broad statement, I would say. There's so many different uses, ranging from radiation treatments for cancer, you know, and then going into the sterilization material used to sterilize tools before any surgery. So if anybody's gone through a surgery, all of the tools were sterilized using a radiological isotope. And there are many, many more radiological isotopes, ranging from iodine to molybdenum-99, like so many different things and so many different applications within the medicine world that nuclear is prevalent.
So we might not even realize where nuclear medicine is fitting in our lives, and it's there. We just don't recognize it or even know it's influencing.
Correct. I mean, one of the most common things is MRI machines. I know a lot of people that go into MRI machines. That's a nuclear technology, right? When those first came out, they were called NMRI machines. You know, it stood for nuclear magnetic resonance imaging machines. And people didn't use it because of the word nuclear, so they just got rid of it. And now it's a very widely used and accepted piece of technology. And same thing, you know, going to the doctor, it's one in three times that you go to the doctor that you're going to be treated by some form of nuclear medicine.
In the movie, there was Richard Feynman, who was an assistant professor at UW-Madison before working on the Manhattan Project, and he is played by the actor Jack Quaid in Oppenheimer. Do you see any of Feynman's influence in your program at the UW?
Not really a ton. No, and I wouldn't say there's a ton at UW that there's his influence. We do a lot of different radiation experiments and things like that, but I don't know a ton about that specific assistant professor other than what I saw in the movie.
There's also been criticism about the film not hearing the voices of the people who had been exposed to the effects of nuclear tests. You know, either they were living downwind or they were working in the nuclear industry. How do you feel about that representation?
Now, I think one thing to take note of is how much the nuclear industry has evolved since then. You know, obviously at the time, we weren't fully aware of what this technology was doing, and we have continued to learn. We are at the point where I had mentioned earlier, nuclear energy powers 20% of America. That is an insane amount of energy coming from one power source, and it needs to actually grow because this is the safest form of power production. And when it comes to the medicine field, you know, like I said earlier, it's changing lives and saving lives in so many different ways that we don't even know about.
talking about Barbenheimer phenomenon with Grace Stanky, Miss America 2023 nuclear engineering student. And you can join the conversation along the way. Call in with a question or a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Grace, we're going to switch gears back to Barbie. And in stories written about Barbie, the doll is said to be from a fictional town called Willows, Wisconsin, before she moved to Malibu. Do you see any relatable Wisconsin influence in the character or the doll, Barbie?
Yeah, you know, like I had said earlier, I haven't seen the movie Barbie yet. But from what I've seen in trailers and from what I know, I think one thing that Barbie has is Midwest nice. You know, that's something that we all know and love. And I think kindness goes a long ways.
So what is your opinion of Barbie dolls? Did you grow up with them or did you grow up playing with them?
Oh, yeah, I definitely had Barbie dolls growing up. I had two older siblings as well. So there was a lot of chaos with older siblings and then being the youngest. But I think that Barbie dolls is a way for a young girl to envision herself in a way that she can't see in the world around her in the community she grows up in, right? It's creating a bigger world for her to dream of.
What did you do with your Barbie's hair? I know mine, I cut it sometimes and it was all different shapes. And
you know, I don't think I did anything. I really don't think I did. I think I was a very neat and orderly child to some extent. We had Legos and I would always break and destroy the Legos and then rebuild it and everything. So nice. I think that was my destructive tendency went towards that.
Do you think that this attention you're receiving as, you know, Barbenheimer, has that helped your advocacy work and the goals as Miss America?
It has a little bit. You know, it's something that it's a totally different sort of demographic with the film fanatics that I've been able to reach with all of this. And it's been a ton of fun because it's opening up the door for people to see that, you know, these are two very unusual, different and polar opposite movies, but there is crossover and that crossover exists.
Where have you been traveling as Miss America? What has your schedule look like?
Ooh, I've been traveling everywhere. I've done about 90,000 miles of travel in the past 8 months. So oh, wow. I was in Phoenix on Monday. I fly to Arkansas on Sunday. Like it's all over the place. I get to do a variety of things ranging from, you know, my social impact initiative, talking about clean energy for a cleaner future. But then also I get to do some fun things where I got to go tandem skydiving with the Army. I got to lay the wreath at Arlington Cemetery. I got to attend the Kentucky Derby. So there's a big variety of things in terms of what I do as Miss America.
Oh, wow. That's so exciting. And then you're able to meet people from all over the country. When they talk with you, what do they ask you? What are those interactions like when you talk with people from all over the country?
Yeah, it really depends on the individual. Honestly, a lot of the times I find myself listening to people because they want to tell me about themselves. When I speak with them, which is something that is truly one of the most rewarding parts of this job, is the opportunity to listen and the opportunity to uplift other people's stories.
Skydiving, will you do it again?
Oh, yeah, I'd do it again if I had the opportunity.
And then, you know, in terms of the events and your speaking engagements, how do you balance that with the rigor of being a college student in a really high demand program?
Well, I am in my like last sort of, when I became Miss America, I only had one semester left of schooling. So with that, I was able to space everything out where I'm doing that entire last semester throughout the rest of this year. So I'm only in two classes this semester, and then I only have one this fall, and then I'm done. And because of that, you know, I've been able to switch courses to be online. I have a really great department down at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that they're willing to be flexible with me and willing to switch to make things online and, you know, be a little bit more flexible with deadlines than I think they would normally be because they understand the circumstances and the fact that I'm working more than full time while doing these courses.
We only have a little bit of time left here, but do you have any advice for people who are trying to juggle multiple things and trying to figure out how to prioritize? How do you do it?
Oh my gosh, write everything down. I always made fun of my dad growing up for making like to-do lists, but now I'm like, I get it. I have to write it down, otherwise I forget it. So I definitely have a running to-do list on my phone that when I say, okay, I'll make sure to get that to you, or oh, I'll make sure to do this, I write that down right away. Otherwise, you know, there's no guarantee I'll remember it.
Grace, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was such a joy.
Grace Stanky is Miss America 2023 and a nuclear engineering student at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a song about Madison.
For a lot of folks in Madison, going to concerts on the square is a summer tradition. For some people, the classical music by the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra is the highlight. But for WPR's Bridget Bowden, the best part is a song called Home to Madison.
Picture this. You're sitting on a blanket on the Capitol lawn in Madison. It's a warm summer evening, and you're listening to beautiful classical music. You're feeling very fancy, sipping wine and eating cheese. But at the end of the concert, when you start to pack up your blanket, you hear this. This is Home to Madison, and it's not fancy. It's basically a country song. They play it at the end of every single concert on the square. And honestly, I love it. I mean, just listen to these lyrics.
Grilling brats on the barbecue. Friends and laughs and hey, what's new? I'm coming home.
So I wanted to know, what is the deal with this song? Where did it come from, and why do they play it here, of all places? I caught up with Andrew Sewell, the musical director of the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, to hear the story. He says it all started with Madison's sesquicentennial back in 2006. They were putting together a time capsule and wanted a signature song to describe Madison. They asked for songwriters to submit entries.
And we got it down to four finalists, and I just wasn't particularly enamored with any of them, and I thought, I know that we can do better than that.
So he called up a friend of his, an electric violinist named Tracy Silverman.
I said, hey, Trace, we've got this thing. Could you just write, say, maybe a 3 or 4 minute song about Madison?
A few days later, Silverman sent a demo of Home to Madison. The judges loved it so much that they made it the fifth finalist, added it to the time capsule, and of course, started playing it at concerts on the square. Silverman lives in Nashville now, but he does have roots here.
You know, I grew up in Wisconsin, and I have to admit, this is kind of on the DL, but I grew up in Beloit, not in Madison. But I spent a lot of time in Madison as a kid.
So he says finding inspiration for the song was easy.
You know, I learned how to drive a car, you know, on the country roads outside Beloit. And it was usually my job to grill the brats, and I'd have a grill full of brats just up in flames because of all that, you know, the way brats do when they grill. And all of that stuff was just in my mind.
Home, where I'm supposed to be.
Musically, he says he was going for something easy and fun to listen to.
I was kind of thinking John Cougar, Mellencamp, or something kind of like that, just sort of real straight up the middle kind of something that everybody would like.
The chorus is easy to sing along to, including my personal favorite lyric, just off Highway 51.
I'm coming home.
Just even though nobody really calls it Highway 51, but it rhymes with Madison, so, you know, sort of.
Silverman knows that it's not the most serious song in the world, but that's the beauty of it, he says.
You know, if I lived in Madison as an adult, I might have had a much more nuanced view of the politics and the economics and all various things that are could be problematic and that people discuss as adults. And I didn't have any of that to burden me, you know. All I had was going swimming in Lake Mendota and stuff like that.
He says of all the music he's ever recorded, this song is probably the one that the most people know, thanks to Concerts on the Square. And he feels good about that legacy.
I couldn't be more honored to have the tune in people's minds as they're leaving that great venue and feeling like, you know, this is their home.
WPR's Bridget Bowden brought us that story on the unofficial anthem of Concerts on the Square, Home to Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum. Home to Madison.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Geology researchers from UW Oshkosh do field work at Jurassic National Monument in Utah, what the U.S. Bureau of Land Management calls the densest concentration of Jurassic aged dinosaur bones ever found. We explore how this quarry provides clues to ancient climate, and you can be part of the discussion. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Joseph Peterson is a geology professor at UW Oshkosh. Joe, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, this is your final day of research at the site in Utah. You're there now. Paint a picture for us. What do you see?
Well, right now I'm looking out over kind of the desert badlands of Jurassic National Monument. The sun is just peeking up over the ridge, so there's some cool dark shadows being cast in some of the valleys, but the desert's just kind of waking up right now.
Oh, it just sounds breathtaking. What do you love it about it there? I mean, I'm sure this is not the first time you've been there.
No, this is actually our 12th field season out here at Jurassic National Monument. We were just discussing this, my crew and I, last night, about what is it that keeps bringing us out here every year. And, I mean, there's a camaraderie in camp. We usually have students and volunteers that you develop some good relationships with. It's hard work, but it's rewarding. Like, we're always finding something new and interesting.
This quarry, the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry at Jurassic National Monument, contains fossils from millions of years ago. Why is understanding what happened then so important to today?
Well, the late Jurassic period in North America was pretty unique. There's really nowhere on Earth today exactly like that. Like what the world looked like, what this part of Utah, for example, looked like in the late Jurassic, there's really nowhere in the world today like it. So it's trying to reconstruct what this looked like and what the climate was like in the ecosystem. So it's more than just digging up dinosaurs. It's trying to put them into a context of a living ecosystem at one point in geologic time.
It's so interesting how you keep putting the pieces together there, because isn't it that they just realized there was a humid forest in northeastern Utah? And, you know, that's been, I think, one of the more recent discoveries of fossil plants as well.
Yeah. I mean, looking at Earth history, we can see how the Earth has changed over time. We can see what some things may have triggered those changes in climate and changes in life. And so by looking at the past, we can kind of get a better understanding of our current time in Earth's context.
So your team is working near the quarry site, uncovering a long-necked dinosaur skeleton called Diplodocus. What are you learning from the dinosaur?
Well, just this week, we found some fragments of bones. What's interesting about this site is, first of all, the rock is very, very hard. It's really slow working. But we've uncovered a thigh bone, we've uncovered some ribs, we've uncovered a lot of vertebrae. But one of the ribs that we found was actually broken prior to being buried. So this tells us that this skeleton probably laid out on the surface back in the Jurassic period for quite a long time after the animal died, but before it was buried. And some of those bone fragments actually have bite marks on them from carnivores. So we're learning more about the relationship of these animals and, again, in their environment at the time.
It sounds like it could have been a pretty violent or scary place. I mean, how did all these carcasses of so many animals end up in this one spot, this one quarry?
Well, in the main Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry, that's really been the big question for about 100 years now. What makes the site unique isn't just that it's the most dense concentration of Jurassic bones, but also that we have three times as many predators as prey, and most of those predators are juvenile. So we're still trying to figure out why we have so many predators, especially the dinosaur Allosaurus, which is by far the most abundant animal here. But over the last 10 to 12 years, my colleagues and I and our students have been studying the sediment that is around the bones. We've been looking at the chemical signatures left in the rock and left in the bone, looking at features on the bones, such as, you know, looking for things like bite marks, or did they look like they laid around at the surface for a long time before burial? And what we're actually starting to find is there are some really unique signatures with the chemistry and also with microscopic fossils preserved with the bones of things called charophytes. They're kind of an algae that was preserved back then. And we're starting to see a pattern that indicates a seasonal pond, or what we call an ephemeral pond. So this might have been an area where animals were congregating, like a watering hole. But during a dry season or a particularly bad dry season, you might have had a large amount of die-off. And then when the rains did come, the carcasses got washed in. So it looks like it wasn't one big immediate event, but actually something that accumulated dinosaurs over a long period of time.
You mentioned the sediments and the rock layers, and I'm just wondering about your work with paleontologists, because, you know, I would imagine paleontologists and geologists really have to kind of work together. Can paleontologists who are studying dinosaurs learn valuable lessons from the rocks and the layers where the fossils are embedded?
Absolutely. And actually, my real background is invertebrate paleontology.
Ah.
So we bring in, it's kind of all encompassing. We actually have geologists, biologists, and vertebrate and invertebrate paleontologists that have worked on aspects of this site and many, many others. It really is a collaboration. Paleontology is kind of the love child of geology and biology.
I've never heard it framed that way. That's fabulous. So it really takes all of these different types of specialties to work together at these sites to piece together what was happening so many million years ago.
Exactly. And, you know, if you think about it, if you find fossils, they're in rocks. So if you don't know biology, it's just a weird shape in a rock. But if you don't know the geology, then you don't understand the historical context or the environmental context of which that organism once lived. So we really do need both.
UW Oshkosh geology professor Joe Peterson leads students in fieldwork at Jurassic National Monument in Utah. Call in with a question, share a comment along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. UW Oshkosh researchers are in Utah trying to interpret the history of a site that contains the densest concentration of dinosaur bones from the Jurassic period ever found. As we explore the excavations and this deposit of fossils, there's room for your question or comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have UW Oshkosh geology professor Joe Peterson here. Let's bring in Sarah in Oshkosh. Sarah, hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. First, I just wanted to say I find your research super interesting. I just love dinosaurs. But to get to my question, which is a two-parter, first, I was wondering, how big is your crew, right? Like, how long are you out there? And with that, are you working with any other doctors, any other fields? Just looking for a little more content of what that looks like for your crew.
Sarah, thank you. Joe, go ahead.
Well, our crew size kind of fluctuates. Right now, we're at about 10 people. Sometimes it's 12, sometimes it's down to 5, though we have had times when we brought entire classes out for a field course, and we've had up to like 25, 26 people in camp at once, which can get a little challenging when you're trying to keep that many people alive in the desert. But yeah, we're also working. This research really is a collaboration with a lot of different universities, particularly my colleague Jonathan Warnock, who's a professor at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. So he and I have been bringing students out here since 2012. And we're also working with the Prehistoric Museum in Price, Utah, and their staff, as well as the Natural History Museum of Utah in Salt Lake and a number of other institutions. So it really is a collaborative effort.
Sarah, does that answer your question? Anything else?
Oh, no, that fully answers my question. I just like to leave with a comment of, I just think it's so cool, so interesting what you all are doing, and I can't wait to see more or hear more later down the line.
Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. Joe, why travel to Utah? Why take the students rather than do things in your own backyard, like dig for dinosaur bones in Wisconsin?
Well, we don't actually have dinosaurs in Wisconsin. They used to probably roam around there, but in order to preserve these as fossils, the animals would have needed to be buried quickly. And back in the Jurassic period, and actually most of the whole Mesozoic era when the dinosaurs were roaming around, the Midwest was, for the most part, dry land. So if they died there, they would just break down and they wouldn't really become good fossils. Utah is one of the most concentrated dinosaur states, if we can put it that way. There's new species being described from Utah all around various geologic units every year, new species of dinosaurs. So it's a great place to bring students. It's one of the best kind of outdoor classrooms for geology and paleontology that I can find.
That's what I was wondering. I mean, how does this field work affect the students who are going through the program, and how important is it to have this type of field experience?
I think field experience is one of the most important things that students can have in any field of study. Really getting out there and getting into it. So we have graduate students that we bring out here, but we also bring undergraduate students that maybe have only had one intro geology class, because you can read about it in a book and you can watch videos about it and do classroom exercises, but to actually be out in the field measuring how thick units of rocks are, excavating bones, learning how to map a quarry, you're surrounded by it. So you really, it kind of becomes part of you in a way.
You're surrounded by it, and you're living it because you're out there camping as well, near the site. What is a typical day like?
We usually wake up around 6:30, have a quick breakfast, and for the last week or so, it's been hiking out to our long-necked dinosaur, which we call a sauropod, our sauropod site, which is about a mile away, but it's over pretty rough terrain. And then while we're out there, it's kind of laying on the rock and slowly chipping away to expose more bones and map the site, but also remembering to drink lots of water while we're out here too. And then we usually stop around 3:30 or 4 because it's starting to get really, really hot, and we have a long walk back and we're running low on water. And then we kind of just cool off for a little while, rehydrate, and then we start dinner. And then in the evening, we'll play games or have a campfire or something like that. Just kind of hang around camp and rest up and talk about the day and talk about what the plans are for the next one.
Oh, thank you for sharing that. Let's go to Kay in Berlin. Kay, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. This is such a fascinating subject. But I was wondering, is it possible to get DNA off of any of the bones or possibly if you find hair or anything like that? Is there any possibility of bringing them back?
Well, I think that like the Jurassic Park idea where we could resurrect dinosaurs from DNA, the bones that we have out here are far too old to really preserve DNA. DNA breaks down pretty quickly, actually. So in more recent dinosaur units, what we call like late Cretaceous material, there have been some fragments of DNA extracted, but not enough that we could do any kind of reconstruction like that. Not to mention, there's been about 6 movies, I think, that show that that's a bad idea. But It is something that, you know, people have talked about. And actually, if you look at it from an evolutionary perspective, we still have a form of dinosaur alive today, and that's birds. They're in the same category of life with dinosaurs as kind of we are with primates. You know, we're primates and other apes and stuff. We share a common ancestor, and birds and dinosaurs do as well. So we can learn a lot about dinosaur behavior from looking at things like birds and crocodiles and reconstruct them that way, but probably not bringing them back Jurassic Park style.
Joe Peterson with us, professor of geology at UW Oshkosh, as we talk about the latest research from a group of students and staff at a dinosaur quarry in Utah. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Joe, you were mentioning the collaborations, and the site there is maintained by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. How do researchers get permission to study or to excavate a site like Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry at Jurassic National Monument?
Well, it's actually something you need to get a permit through the Department of the Interior to actually excavate and collect vertebrate fossils on public lands. And that's just because we don't want all of these things taken out of the ground and sold on eBay. You know, we want to be able to make sure they are reposited in museums so that they're available for everyone to study. So we work very closely with the Department of the Interior and the Bureau of Land Management to secure permits. And you know, we start out with what's called a surface collecting permit, which we go out, and that means that we can collect things that are on the surface or disrupt a small amount of sediment around it. Nobody wants to go to a national monument just to see a bunch of holes dug in the ground. But if we do find something that's important and sizable, such as this sauropod we're digging up, this Diplodocus, then we can get an excavation permit, and we work again closely with the BLM and the Department of the Interior to make sure that we're not disrupting any, you know, fragile wildlife that might be in that specific spot. And then there's ways of kind of cleaning up the site when we're done removing the skeleton.
Do you feel the protections are enough for these sites to ensure that they remain abundant and viable for research in the decades to come?
I think they do a really good job out here. They have a program of protect and respect, right? So it's kind of when you go hiking in a park and it says, you know, take only pictures and leave only footprints. It's similar to that. What we really encourage visitors to Jurassic National Monument and other fossil-rich national monuments and parks to do is if you do happen to see bones or something like dinosaur bones weathering out of a rock, take pictures, get GPS coordinates, and share that with the Bureau of Land Management or park rangers. That way they can get trained paleontologists out there to help carefully, you know, preserve them or kind of just figure out what they want to do with that particular specimen rather than dig it up yourself.
Sounds like a really important tip there. Joe, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Joe Peterson is a professor of geology at UW Oshkosh, and we want listeners like you to be part of the conversation on the morning show. Save our call-in number to make it easier when something comes up for you in one of these conversations. It's 800-642-1234. That number again to save, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.